From Canada Land, this is Oppo.
Hi, I'm Sandy Garasino in Vancouver.
And I'm Jen Gerson in Calgary, the most glorious place on the planet this week. How have you been, Sandy?
Been pretty good. No hailstorms?
Oh my goodness, no. We've had like 22 degree weather and the leaves are
turning. Gorgeous?
It's just, I've never experienced a fall this perfect.
I hope everybody in Canada is having a beautiful fall to go along with sitting inside. As we're recording, we're waiting for Donald Trump to emerge through the golden gates of the hospital. And there will be, I'm sure, music.
I'm sure that the Donald Trump should definitely be leaving the hospital this early. That seems fine to me.
I think he should be committed as a threat to himself and others. I mean, the man has COVID. He has a highly communicable and lethal illness, and the White House is riddled with it. And now we've got Mike Pence, who is the man in charge of the task force, the COVID task force, and his team is laughing at Kamala Harris for wanting to take precautions at a debate when he's supposed to be in quarantine. This is like, anyway, what can we say? It's all fine.
On the theme of everything's fine, Donald Trump has offered a far-right group their brand new slogan.
Like many others, I'm incredibly concerned about how Donald Trump did not explicitly condemn right-wing extremism and these Proud Boys.
Not only did he merely not condemn them, he, during the presidential debate, advised them to stand back and stand by, which sounded to me an awful lot like he was kind of inciting violence a little bit. And people forget, Proud Boys is actually founded by a Canadian guy named Gavin McGinnis.
So it occurred to us this week that a lot of famous alt-right types and white supremacist types and militia types come from Canada and gain notoriety abroad.
Gavin McGinnis and Ezra Levant and Lauren Southern and Faith Goldie. It just strikes me as fascinating. What is it about Canadian culture that seems to produce these countercultural figures and then that we then export to the United States?
It's a true mystery. So for this episode, Jen and I want to go and do a deep dive into the Canadian connection. We're going to talk to Dr. Barbara Perry. She is the director of the Center on Hate, Bias, and Extremism at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology.
She'll break down the role of Proud Boys in Canada and whether we're on to something here. Why is it that this country creates some of these personalities despite our reputation for multiculturalism and left-leaning progressivism more generally? Should we be worried that Donald Trump's remarks might encourage extremism either here or in the United States?
Oh, we've come so far from cultural exports like maple syrup and hockey and female singers and the Raptors. Here we are.
Everything's fine, Sandy. It's fine. Just keep saying it's fine.
It's fine. It's fine, Jen.
It's fine. It's fine. But first, here are a few non-Trump-related headlines.
Yes. So CERB officially ended as of Saturday, October 3rd, 2020, but there should be a relatively seamless transition to EI if you still need income support. As of yesterday, Monday, October 5th, people can apply for two additional benefits through the Canada Revenue Agency, a new sick leave benefit, and a new caregiver benefit. The caregiver benefit is for those who need to take time off work to take care of a dependent. Boy, I know so many people will so benefit from that. This was pushed through by Bill C-4, which created a new Canada Recovery Benefit for gig workers and others who don't qualify for EI, as well as sick leave benefit and caregiver benefit. CERB helped almost 9 million Canadians, and it's worth noting that the Government of Canada has actually legislated that EI will now match CERB's offering for a year. So whereas previously EI was $400 a week, it will now match CERB's offering of $500 a week. This was a maneuver from the NDP, and reports say that it was part of the NDP voting in favor of the throne speech. As a result, the Liberals have passed their first confidence vote, and looks like no election.
No election! Woohoo!
No election!
Meanwhile, the other thing I wanted to mention was that, hey, remember that Liberal promise that there would be open nominations in their nominations?
Yes.
In their writing? Yeah, yes. Apparently that's not a thing anymore. That's stopped.
So, what?
Yeah.
A Liberal promise is not a promise?
I know you're shocked. Be still your heart, Sandy. Be still your heart. So, you know, Justin Ling actually wrote about this for The Line. Justin Ling, former co-host of Oppo. And he noted that Toronto Center and New York, they just sort of just parachuted people in because that's just what they do now. So that's fine.
And The Green Party has a new leader, Toronto lawyer Annamie Paul, who will be running in this very Toronto Centre by-election. Paul is the first Black Canadian and first Jewish woman to be elected leader of a major federal party in Canada. So congratulations to Annamie Paul.
That'll actually be an interesting race in Toronto Centre.
Well, it will be interesting because it is sort of the coming out party for the new Green Party leader. And I think that there will be attention.
I wonder how competitive they'll be. Like, Toronto Centre's a pretty staunchly Liberal riding. It's a high risk, high play reward, man.
Are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups, sure, and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
willing to
specifically
do, that,
do it?
Well,
I
go
would
ahead,
say
sir.
I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and right
Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Dr. Barbara Perry. Proud Boys got a shout out last week at the U.S. presidential debate, and a lot of Canadians who've been following the issue of right-wing and white supremacist nationalism were extremely shocked by this. Well, everybody was. Tell us your reaction when you heard about this.
Well, I don't know that we should necessarily have been shocked, because this has been his position all along. He's really failed to denounce these kinds of actors, and he's made claims before about good people on both sides, as he said about Charlottesville. He referred to himself at one point as a nationalist. So for me, as someone who's following the news from the South and following the far right, this is not necessarily something that's surprising. The fact that he did it in the context of a debate and it was so public and so widely watched, did not seem a very presidential thing to say in that sort of context.
It was more than just he didn't denounce them, though. I mean, he almost seemed to be encouraging them or explicitly sort of telling them that, a time for violence is imminent. I mean, that's, I think, what shocked a lot of people, is that this seemed to go way beyond what Trump had done before.
Yeah. And it was the follow-up, right? So it wasn't just stand back and stand by, but it was followed by somebody has to do something about these leftists and these Antifa. And so it really was, as you say, right? That was promotion of hatred, promotion of violence, incitement. In the Canadian context, those are, those rise to the level of criminal behaviors. I think you're right that to be that explicit is not just surprising and shocking, but dangerous.
Can we just go back and describe who the Proud Boys are and also the Canadian connection, especially Gavin McInnes?
Sure. Well, the Proud Boys, I first became aware of them probably 4 or 5 years ago when they started to circulate some videos. And to be frank, I found it hard to take them seriously at that point, because they really appeared to me to be, a bunch of overaged frat boys. The videos were comical in an odd sort of way, and that's the way I think that they were intended to be, that it was a lark. Yeah, they were racist and offensive, but they weren't really hardcore white supremacists. They began very quickly to catch on somehow. And I think that fed into their egos. And so you started to see chapters pop up all across the U.S. and Canada. The first time we saw them was a couple of years ago on Canada Day, when they disrupted the Indigenous demonstration and protest of the Cornwallis statue down in Halifax. And so that was our first hint that they had come home, if you will. Since then, I think that what we're seeing, and this has come out of interviews that I've been doing over the past few months with law enforcement and anti-racist organizers, is that we're seeing chapters of Proud Boys now across the country in virtually every large community and some smaller ones as well. So they are very active in the Canadian context as well. And I think that part of that may be because, that the founder was Canadian and there's a certain solidarity with him.
So who is Gavin McInnes, and how was the organization founded?
Well, it's interesting because McGuinness started here with Vice. In fact, I think he was one of the co-founders of Vice, which we recognize as, you know, pretty far to the left, pretty progressive, and then broke ways with them, started moving decidedly to the right, ended up with Rebel Media, which is further right probably than Vice is to the left even, and then, you know, made his way to the U.S. and engaging with sort of those we think of as alt-right in the American context. So it's an interesting trajectory that he's gone through. You know, he claims to not be affiliated with Proud Boys anymore, but while he was leader, he posted quite regularly about, you know, his hatred or fear or ridicule of immigrants, of Muslims in particular, of feminists. So the racism was blended with the sort of the misogyny and patriarchal values and the need to control women as well.
I was wondering if you could give me a sense of how many people actually consider themselves Proud Boys. You know, if there's only 100 Proud Boys across North America, you know, they're not going to be able to do all that much. Do they actually have enough mass to become a significant threat after Election Day?
I think before Election Day, they represent a significant threat because there are fears that people are, you know, that are associated with the Proud Boys will be engaging in voter intimidation, that they'll be showing up at Republican rallies to cheer them on and at Democratic rallies to disrupt them. So I think that there are concerns even leading up to the election, and certainly after the election, especially if Trump should lose. I just have these horrible images of Proud Boys circling the White House and protecting him from the FBI, who will come to, you know, take him out of the Oval Office.
But granted, you don't need a huge amount of people to disrupt a rally and these sorts of tactics, of course. But you need a certain critical mass of followers. Do we know how many followers the Proud Boys actually have?
In Canada, we know, as I said, that we've got chapters in most major cities. You know, those are groups of two or three up to a couple of dozen in some of the larger centers. So certainly in the Canadian context, we've probably got at least a couple of hundred, maybe more. So, you know, if it's proportionate in the U.S. even, that's a couple of thousand. But the other thing to keep in mind is that they don't act alone. They don't act in isolation, but rather in solidarity with other groups. And so even in the Canadian context, we've seen them at rallies with the likes of the Hammerskins and the Three Percenters. You know, they were a big part of the Charlottesville protests, whatever you want to call them. That's the danger, is the increasing coalition building that we're seeing amongst groups that share some core values and orientations. In this case, you know, sort of that pro-Trump resolve in particular.
Do academics or law enforcement, as far as you know, have an idea of what kind of numbers are involved here of all the groups?
I don't think so. I think we have a sense of the number of groups that are active. I mean, the FBI, for example, has been saying for some time now, 3 or 4 years, that the greatest threat to national security and public disorder and public safety is, in fact, the far right. So that would suggest to me that in terms of the movement, they are fearing, you know, fairly large numbers. I wouldn't say necessarily, you know, organized numbers, but fairly large numbers. It's much more difficult to identify, you know, the number of people that are involved. I mean, you can't just go to the website. Le Mot, for example, in Quebec, claimed very early on that they had 40,000 active members, you know, which was an wild exaggeration. No doubt, but you know, unless they say this is our membership, it's really difficult. You can't go by the number of, you know, likes and hits and all of that. But from the amount of activity online and offline, there's no doubt in my mind that in the last 4 years, the numbers of groups and numbers of individuals has increased dramatically.
In the Canadian context, of course, it was just about a week or so ago that there was an anti-racism demonstration in Red Deer that was violently disrupted. We had issues with RCMP and policing response to that. We don't actually need a very large organization for them to leap to the headlines and get on the front page and be in the news and to be violent and intimidating of individuals, even here in Canada. What are you seeing as far as the influence in Canada itself?
Well, the sorts of things that you've mentioned, after the last Trump election, we did see a lot of activity on the ground. We saw a lot of rallies sponsored by the far right. This is when we began to see that sort of coalition building. And they lasted for a good couple of years. during COVID, you know, as with most of us, even they, you know, had a fairly low profile offline, but have begun again in the context of, you know, sort of, again, marching shoulder to shoulder with the anti-maskers and the anti-vaxxers. So we've seen them taking these sorts of stances, right, on the basis of their own positions, but we've also seen them disrupting these sorts of activities, anti-racism rallies across the country. Alberta seems to have been a particular hotspot. I've talked to a number of journalists from Alberta in the last couple of days, and there's been a lot of activity, that kind of disruptive activity, not just in Red Deer, but in Edmonton and Calgary as well. And I think we'll start to see this spreading again to other areas.
You know, someone who sort of had her ear to the ground in conservative politics for many, many years, you know, after 9/11 and the years after it, there was a high degree of fear and frankly, paranoia about Islamic terrorism, Islamic extremism. And, you know, as time has worn on, we found that that fear and paranoia wasn't totally misguided. There was some element there, but it was really radically blown out of proportion. The number of Muslims who were engaged in anything of that nature were utterly, utterly marginal, fraction of a fraction of a percent. You know, of course, we had the rise of the Islamic State in the Middle East. There were a lot of sort of particular geopolitical factors that contributed to that. But particularly in North America, it was pretty minor. And now we seem to have watched this shift. We're now not so concerned about Islamic terrorism. We're definitely seeing a rise in right-wing extremism, particularly online. The ISD just did a report fairly recently, sort of doing an examination of the chatter from right-wing groups in Canada. And whenever I see this stuff, it's really interesting to me because, of course, I see headlines about it, and it looks really scary, and it looks like it's this growing phenomenon. And then, you know, you scroll down to the actual numbers. And, for example, that Red Deer protest that Sandy pointed out, you know, we're talking 30 people showed up to it. Or, you know, you scroll through the report, and they're saying, hey, we identified 6,000 Twitter users, of which, like, 12% were really active, in a country of 37 million people. You know, I'm not saying that this is not an issue that we need to be paying attention to. Obviously, it doesn't take very many crazy people to do a lot of damage. But are we allowing ourselves to get carried away in the same way that I saw conservatives get carried away 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it is about sort of the relative impact and the relative numbers. This is one of the reasons I started, you know, looking into the far right, is because I was really annoyed with the obsession with Islamist-inspired extremism to the exclusion of anything else except for the left. You know, they're also very worried about the left, whoever they are. Just to put it in context, in that first study that we did that we published in 2015, between 1985 and 2014 or so, we identified over 120 incidents of violence associated with far right extremism. And that was, you know, right, went all the way up to murder and arsons and firebombs and those sorts of things. During the same period of time, we could identify 8 incidents of Islamist-inspired violence in those whatever 15 years. No, I guess that's 30 years. And also think about, you know, the lone actors. And this is, I think, what one of the greatest emerging concerns is the lone actors, which is a bit of a, you know, misnomer, because while they acted alone, they were very much inspired by, you know, their online mobilization. So again, between 2014, 2018, we had 19 homicides just in mass homicides, 19 homicides associated with the far right. Justine Bort killed 3 RCMP officers in Moncton. Bizanet, of course, killed 6 Muslim men in Quebec City, and then Manassian killed 10 people in Toronto. So I don't know that we're exaggerating necessarily, but there is legitimate reason to be concerned about not just the violence, but also the narratives, because it's a very different narrative here. This is sort of an insider narrative in some respects, that you know, there are problems with our country, and it's because of those immigrants, it's because of those, you know, LGBTQ people, it's because of those feminists. So it's a very reactionary narrative that has an impact not just on like-minded others and that audience, but also has an impact on those who are its targets, who are made to feel that they don't belong by these very narratives.
It's almost as if how large is the group is less of an issue than how lethal a threat does it represent to public safety.
Yeah, you're right. And some of the groups are, you know, sort of explicitly violent. The Proud Boys, for example, I mean, one of their lines goes, you know, we love our guns. So they're engaging the gun rights narrative. One of the steps in initiation into the group included very early on the need to beat someone up, especially someone who is, you know, from Antifa. So violence is bred in the bone of so many of these groups. And I think that that really is the worrying factor in the Canadian context. And they've been, you know, quite explicit about the need to defend themselves and the nation, so that, you know, that distortion of patriotism is their justification, their rationale for what they would claim is defensive violence. So, for example, we've also got the accelerationist elements of the movement, like in the U.S., the Boogaloo Boys, who were, you know, some inroads in Canada, but also the base in Attamwaffen that have been more active in the Canadian context. And these are folks who, you know, rabble rouse and stir up trouble and try to promote, depending on their perspective, either an all-out civil war or a racial holy war, you know, as the ultimate resolution to this problem that they identify of changing demographics and irresponsible, from their perspective, immigration policies and practices.
An observation that Sandy and I were making before the show was that, you know, Canada used to be well known for exporting celebrities and female singers and comedians. And now all of a sudden, if you look at sort of like our most notable or notorious figures coming out of Canada, it's people like Lauren Southern and Faith Goldie and Ezra Levant and Gavin McInnes, or it's people who are kind of on the ideological dark web kind of side, who I think deserve to be distinguished from white nationalists very clearly. But, you know, the Jordan Peterson types or the Gad Saad types or the Lauren Chen types. And it seems to me that we have this thing in this culture where we create these extreme counterculture figures and then export them into the American market. Oh, I would add Steven Crowder, for example. You know, we seem to create these personalities or figures who can't seem to get a foothold within the Canadian market, go to America to seek a larger audience, generate quite a lot of profile and income from that. And I'm wondering, have you studied that phenomenon? Is that dynamic well understood?
not at all. And I think it's a really interesting observation. And as you began to talk, I was thinking about, you know, they are countercultural icons, you know, sort of the mirror image of what we thought of as countercultural icons in the 1960s. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we are, I think, complacent, and we're very self-conscious of this image, international image we have of being such an inclusive and equitable, society, you know, whether it's true or not is another matter. But these sorts of actors recognize that there is some small audience for that in the Canadian context, but certainly realize that they're on a larger stage. And I would say it's not just that they've garnered attention in the U.S., but in Europe and Australia as well. Countries that actually do have a larger receptive audience, I think, to these sorts of ideals. They're so far out of the pale of the way we like to think about ourselves, or beyond the pale of what we like to think about ourselves. And they didn't get much traction. If you remember, I think it was Levant even that tried to launch Sun TV that would rival Fox. And it just got no uptake. There was no interest in it.
But, you know, it's interesting that I think Ezra Levant is almost a clear example of this. Like, you had someone who realized pretty quickly that in order to build something economically sustainable for himself, he was going to have to branch out outside of the Canadian market very aggressively, and he did. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I just kind of wonder, what about this culture seems to create or hone these types of figures? The economic incentive for them to go outside the country is very clear to me. I'm just wondering what it is about the culture itself that seems to create and hone these particular types of figures.
Well, I think they did get a lot of blowback in the Canadian context from other media sources, from general public as well. I mean, even if you look on some of their social media platforms, there was a lot of negative. There are a lot of negative responses to their kind of coverage. There are a lot of positive ones, you know, don't get me wrong, but there is a lot of resistance, I think, to their messaging.
I wonder if that's blowback is actually what contributed to their fame, right? Like, it's the blowback
to their success.
Jordan Peterson has openly stated that. Like, he's openly stated, and I think Canada Land did a great podcast about this, but he stated, you know, I've found a way to basically hack left-wing outrage, you know, for my own financial benefit. Like, this is very consciously done. So I wonder, I wonder if there's something about the sort of the degree of social cohesion that we have in Canada that sort of expels these people and probably to some extent even radicalizes them and puts them in a position where they're able to sort of translate that exile into fame and wealth overseas. I think that there's a dynamic there that's worth exploring a bit.
There absolutely is, and I will give that due consideration. But yeah, I think there is a sense of being emboldened by that backlash, right? That they're quite happy to have touched a nerve. It's almost like Trump, you know, when he first started, you know, the campaign, his initial campaign. You know, no one thought he was serious until people started to take him seriously. And he thought, oh, well, you know, there's a buck to be made here. There's, you know, there's attention, there's fame, there's fortune. And I think it's, you know, it's a very similar thing. You know, let's play on this. Let's exploit this notoriety, if you will, to enhance our own reputation and standing.
Dr. Perry, one of the questions that I have is about the interplay between the public-facing entities, many of which absolutely deny that they are any part of incitement to violence or any of this disruption that we've been discussing. They'll just say, well, they're about freedom of speech and expressing opinions. Then the interplay between that public-facing narrative and the more concerning elements of the recruitment of individuals who actually do pose a threat. How does the public face of the media platform interplay with the organizing that appears to be going on?
The movement has become a little more canny in terms of the way it represents itself. This is the trend that we're seeing across the movement is a recoding of the language. So you talk about that public face, and it's very not neutral language, but more palatable language. So, you know, they don't talk about hatred of particular groups. Some of them still do. Some of them are still quite blatant. But for example, one of the slides that I often use when we're talking about the Proud Boys, to go back to them, is one where, you know, this is where you see their catchphrase, we're Western chauvinists who refuse to apologize for creating the modern world. Then they go on to say, we venerate the housewife, we cherish free speech, we love our guns. So free speech, for example, we cherish free speech. So a lot of the far-right rallies that we've been seeing in the last couple of years describe themselves as free speech rallies. So this has become a code for, you know, instead of saying PC, it's now a code for, you know, the resistance to what they see as, you know, too much progressive policy. So, the public face is muted very often on traditional platforms like Facebook, where they still have a space, less muted in places like Telegram and Gab, and of course in their closed chats, which is where, you know, the real scheming and planning and dirty work goes on. So these groups, you know, sort of try to aim for plausible deniability in terms of the language. I mean, one of the other strategies they use is to include, you know, people of color in their membership, for example. Well, we can't possibly be racist, else we wouldn't have, you know, Latino members or Black members. I guess the problem for me is this, it's almost an American style veneration for free speech in the sense that it is unfettered and it is absolute, which in the American context, it almost is. We have good, you know, precedent around the definition of what is hate speech. There, you know, people think it's a blurry line. I think it's a pretty fine line in terms of, you know, what constitutes hate speech and dangerous speech, more importantly.
Research on right-wing extremism is still in its nascent stages. Although you've been at this for a while now, where do you hope to see it go?
Oh, more of the same. I mean, we, as you say, we have so little research here. There's, you know, there's been some really interesting work in Quebec, for example, around the lingering skinhead movement and the skinhead music scene and how that contributes. I think we just need a whole lot more on the ground monitoring of the groups on an ongoing basis so that we get a sense, you know, that quantitative risk, but also the qualitative threat. So, you know, for example, we have our research assistants doing media scans, you know, on a daily basis. what kinds of incidents are we seeing? What kinds of activities are they engaged in? Because there's a tendency, especially when we talk to law enforcement, there's a tendency not to see the big picture. We've had a couple of incidents here in this community, but, you know, that doesn't really mean anything. Well, when you add that, you know, those couple of incidents to the couple of incidents that are happening in, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 other cities, then there is a problem. And so I think that is really important to continue to document the activity and the breadth of their activity, right? That it's not just an Edmonton or even just an Alberta phenomenon, but it's also something what we've discovered this time around. There's a lot of activity in the Maritime provinces, for example, that we didn't capture the first time around. So it really is, you know, sort of, I think we're garnering more and more evidence that it really is coast to coast, maybe not that third coast. We don't seem to see much activity in the territories.
In the north. Well, and it's so vital for Canadians to be kept abreast of exactly what is going on and what we should be watching for. Dr. Barbara Perry, thank you so much for joining us today and enlightening us with this information, which is so important. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
What did you think, Jen? How did you think that interview went?
I thought it was a super interesting interview. I mean, I did tweak a little bit to the idea that particularly this is a specific problem to Alberta, which I don't think was her point. But I think it's worth exploring a little bit because I have a personal story that I would love to share if you'd be willing, Sandy.
Sure.
When I first came to Alberta back in 2010, one of the first sort of real stories that I got to cover was this case of, or the story of, a handful of neo-Nazis who were doing kind of like their annual protest in Calgary. And as per what had become a tradition, they were massively swarmed by anti-racists. And there were like protests and counter-protests. They were yelling at each other. And in years previous, this had sort of escalated into a squabble. It escalated into street violence. And this had kind of continued. And over the times that I've been here, I've noticed that these sorts of incidents have become sort of less common and then more common, and they kind of morphed. So when you brought up that case in Red Deer, I was kind of intrigued by it because it reminded me of stuff that I'd seen here in Alberta previously. I think that both the left and the right in this country treat Alberta with disproportionate symbolic significance. The left sort of latches on to these cases of isolated street theater, and they use it as proof that this Alberta is this racist place and therefore conservatives are racist. Like it becomes that kind of a narrative. And the far right sees Alberta as potentially a vanguard for potential new followers. And it creates this this alluring space for this kind of really performative stuff to play out. And of course, the media loves these types of stories because there's conflict, there's drama, there's all kinds of great stuff. But when I click through to these stories, it's always like, you know, 12 racists show up in a parking lot in Edmonton. Or, you know, in the last case story you cited, it was, you know, 30 people in Red Deer. In all of these cases, the races are massively outswamped by anti-racists. So, I think that there's a lot going on in that dynamic that is worth sort of picking apart and exploring. And I just don't think it's ever as simple as all the racists are in Alberta, that this is in any way representative, because it's not representative.
Everybody knows that these kinds of conflicts and confrontations could happen anywhere in Canada. And this emerging threat of racism and perhaps even street violence and street confrontation or even terrorist acts could happen, does happen everywhere. So to me, the geography is not that important. What's kind of more interesting is the relationship between the movement per se, how many people are in the Proud Boys, how many people are in the Three Percenters or the Oath Keepers or these or Le Mut and each of these organizations. That's one question. But actually, it's the lone actors who are inspired by a lot of the rhetoric that they see that is the real public safety threat. Donald Trump has tweeted that he's asking people to volunteer to be election poll watchers. The fear and intimidation and attacks on the public, the potential for attacks on the public is just turning into a five-alarm fire, it seems to me.
I mean, I'm big on this election could go very, very badly. I'm very, very concerned about acts of civil unrest and civil violence leading up to the election and afterwards. Like that, I'm very much on that train. But, you know, here in Canada, it's just really interesting to me who gets the bad rap and who doesn't. You know, I've got Stats Can open up, and you know which city in Canada appears to have the highest hate crime rate per 100,000 population, and highest by far, and it's not close?
Probably the city that has the highest visible minority quotient.
It's Hamilton. It's Hamilton by far.
This is not really about, well, where are they? This is a Canadian problem. And it could happen anywhere. It doesn't surprise me that it happens in Hamilton, because I think that the area around Toronto has a high number of members of visible minorities, Black, Indigenous, people of color, and those people get attacked and they will complain more than a largely white population does.
Vancouver has a fairly high rate. 7.1 per 100,000.
We have a high number of visible minority people.
Thunder Bay, 8 per 100,000. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting to me. That's all. Ottawa has like 9.8. Like anyway, like it's not the breakdown that you would necessarily expect. It really isn't.
Why would you expect a largely white population to have a higher number of racist incidents? You're going to have the higher number of racist incidents in populations that are heavily racialized. No?
I'm trying to sort of break stereotypes, because I think the stereotypes feed into respective narratives that are harmful, that are just really, really harmful. It's a dangerous narrative because it assumes that like all of the racism is happening in the conservative enclave. You know what I mean? And the truth is, I just don't think that's true. I think that racism is a cross-country phenomenon, and that we fundamentally agree on. Now it's time for the mailbag question this week. How much will Canada benefit from the money that is not being spent in the US by cross-border shoppers and snowbirds grounded this year by the closed border? From Mike Bodnar by email. Mike, you know what? Neither of us are economists, and so we're not super well placed to answer that question. But if I were to guess, I'm going to guess that Canada is not going to benefit very much by this for two reasons. One, online shopping seems to be eating up the money that we're not spending elsewhere, and a lot of that money basically goes back to the States. And secondly, I think that the businesses that are really suffering as a result of COVID are the very local boutiques, retail stores that prop up a Canadian sort of a fashion retail industry. So my just random guess is that it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. Sandy?
It's interesting because I did look into the data a little bit, and after...
Oh, you just did research. Well, fine. Make me look bad.
Anyway, I did look into this, and there was a huge, an enormous dip in consumer spending in April, about 40% drop year over year, much of which has largely recovered. Restaurant and grocery spending has recovered, and clothing and education spending has gone way down. And that is where we see the small businesses getting hurt. And I think that as we go forward, we will continue to see pressure on small businesses. And I think what this pandemic has really done, it's not so much the travel spending as it's been that this has hyper accelerated the mass movement to online buying. And most of that money, or a lot of that money, is going to go straight across the border. So whether you're traveling or you're not, a lot of that money is still going south of the border, and it is our small retailers. And these are our community businesses, you know. So maybe the one thing we could do here is have a shout out. Please support your local businesses. These are our families. These are our neighbors, and they need our support. If you have a question you'd like us to answer, tweet us at OppoCast, or you can email us at oppo@canadalandshow.com.
That's it for Oppo this week. We'll be back again in 2 weeks.
Once again, the ways to get in touch are at oppo@canadalandshow.com or on Twitter at OppoCast.
This episode was produced by Tiffany Lamb with additional production support from Damalula Anime. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt, and the theme music is by Nathan Burley.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.